From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, the second of two interviews with people attending a retreat for gay priests this week in Racine.
It's not unlike other conferences I've gone to that have assisted me in preaching, for instance, about immigration reform or about the death penalty. These are hot-button issues, and so I'm not naturally born with the words.
Later, sports contributor Sean Ranft joins us to look back at everything that went right for the Brewers in September and how they stack up against their playoff opponents, the Colorado Rockies.
And ukulele ambassador Lil Rev shares some songs and talks about how the instrument made Americans participants in music rather than observers.
I mean, the instrument got America singing again. You know, we needed that. We needed to find our voice again at a time when almost everything seemed to sound alike or canned or what have you.
Lake Effect is next. First, this news update. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. We heard yesterday on this show from Father Greg Greiton of St. Bernadette's Parish in Milwaukee. He's attending the retreat for gay priests being held at Racine's Siena Center this week.
The spiritual retreat is called Living in Truth, the Call to Authenticity, and involves personal reflection, prayer, and some formal talks. Another pastor attending is Father Michael Shanahan of Our Lady of Lourdes Church in Chicago.
He explains to Lake Effect's Mayan Silver that his journey of coming out to his parish has helped him forge more genuine relationships and minister around LGBT issues. He starts by explaining his experience coming out publicly.
It was a general level of acceptance all around. One thing that stands out, and the most salient thing that stands out, are the stories that I heard from particular parishioners whose relatives or friends have had this issue in their lives, the issue of homosexuality or being gay or lesbian or bisexual, and with whom they've journeyed with these people, and they have just been so grateful that someone in a position like the priesthood would mention this and say this and that they can connect with, and that they didn't have to sort of hide this from their own parish priest or maybe even their fellow parishioners. So I think it helped them create a sense of freedom and safety. You know, that's the effect that it's been on them. Some people were not very happy about it. So I made a point of seeking out the people that I knew who were not happy about it. And we sat down and had conversations. And why was this important? Where are they coming from? Where was I coming from? How does the faith fit into this? Why did I see this as necessary? And frankly, in my opinion, all of those people, I am still very much on very good terms with in the parish. So the experience has just been a wonderful journey that a gay person need not hide and be isolated. A person who has that orientation, even in this role in society, you know. And so that's how it's functioned. So this all happened at this parish, and I'm in my 11th year here, and this is one of the greatest blessings of my life.
So you mentioned that you talked to people about why it was an important thing, that you felt like it was important. What were some of those reasons that you told them?
Mm-hmm. To answer that question, I oftentimes think about what is a priest? And I think a certain dimension of priesthood has to do with trying to facilitate or participate in, witness the healing power of God. That means a lot. There's a lot to that statement. But one thing that is extremely healing is, I believe, when a person comes to acknowledge a certain part of themselves, moves away from any version of self-hatred, comes to a level of self-acceptance, self-appreciation. That in itself then reverses negativity within, allows you to be more genuine and compassionate with others. It's one thing to talk about that publicly from the ambo or in any setting in the third person. It's a very different thing to talk about that when you yourself are identifying with that process. And in this particular case, it was a struggle. That always was a struggle for me, just accepting being a gay, Anglo-American, professional, educated male from the south side of Chicago. And so throughout the course of the journey, there were many twists and turns. My hope has been that doing so might facilitate that healing process for other people. What I've seen is it does. It does. I'm extremely grateful for people that have been able to talk some things through that they weren't able to do that at all in their lives. So, especially in this day and age, that need not be an issue for people to still struggle so much with, but it is an issue. And it causes tremendous internal strife and division within the person themselves. So a priest is somebody that ought to be an agent of the healing power of God, and I'm talking about doing that in a very, very real way. Personally, it was part of my journey. So I think I try, I'm not sure I do this, but I try to affirm that journey of healing by doing this publicly.
And the context of the church itself, the Catholic Church that you have chosen to give your life to, essentially, that is a space that doesn't necessarily have the most easy relationship with homosexuality. And so how has that context shaped kind of where you see yourself?
That's very, very true. And the church, the word Catholic means universal. So in fact, there's all kinds of diversity within the Roman Catholic Church. In fact, there's all kinds of people who would identify themselves as gay, lesbian, or bisexual. And in fact, they're still in the church, and they love the church, as do I. And so my hope is to help us to remain, to actually continue to find the blessing in this faith journey, even though this is a part of your life. In fact, this part of your life becomes really a fountain through which you come to experience God. We talk about God's love in church a lot. And yet, the interpretation of the Catholic Church is perceived by some to be the opposite of that when it comes to homosexuality. So our role is to break that down and to see how can we experience this that we call God's love. Yes, even, of course, within the Roman Catholic Church. There is no doubt that there is a tremendous, what would you call it, an irony, a tremendous invisible divide. There's no doubt about that. And I think there's many people that feel that they're second-class citizens in the Roman Catholic Church. And we don't need to feel that way. I'm talking about people that aren't. I'm not talking about gays. I'm talking about, you know, maybe divorced people, remarried people, people that take issue with all kinds of teachings. There's many people. And so learning to live with the ambiguity and trusting and believing that God is somehow present in that, in the questions. I live at that question. I live where the question that you just described, that's where I live in terms of that tension. And I believe it's turned out to be a tremendous source of grace for me personally, but also others as well.
Do you feel like it's important to have healthy public examples of gay priests that can be visible for people?
You know, absolutely. That is worth mentioning. I think there's plenty of healthy examples of healthy gay, lesbian women, at least around Chicagoland, for sure. I'd like to contribute to that. So, absolutely.
In the priesthood or sisterhood?
Yes, exactly. But I was even just talking about general culture in general. Not too long ago, there weren't, as you know. There weren't many people that were identified that way in a public way. And so, absolutely, it's about freedom. I don't mean freedom in the sense that we think of it socially so much, freedom to do whatever you want. It's about being at one with who you are, you know, freedom.
I'm wondering if you've had a particular example of an interaction with a parishioner on this topic.
There have been numerous conversations where I've been talking not directly with sons or daughters or nieces and nephews or relatives, you know, the young people, but I'm talking to parents and grandparents who don't know how to handle this and have had no preparation in life whatsoever to handle this. They should know how to handle this. Nobody prepares people for this. And so these retreats have equipped me with all kinds of resources to be able to work with these people, because I've seen families separate over this. I've seen the effect, personally, I've seen the effects of people who've been asked to leave their families. I've been involved in situations I don't even like to recall, because suicide's not a good thing. So my point is, these retreats and the fellowship that maybe is generated from it provides me with all kinds of resources to try to work with these people.
And maybe that's another very important reason to be out and open about it, is that you're ministering to people who are facing an issue that can tear people apart.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And when they see a Roman collar, when they see me as the priest, they're just assuming that, you know, this is going to be just sort of a harsh negative reaction. But when they hear maybe there's more to this, or they hear a certain degree of welcoming or respect or compassion from preaching in respect to this issue, definitely. It creates a safe space for them to approach me.
Have you had an experience where people, a family was able to reconcile more easily, or an older generation was able to accept you and so they accepted their grandson or whatever, or maybe they're not as explicit about that?
So I've had numerous examples where I came into the picture at a particular point in the struggle within the family. And I have seen one where they came to a place of acceptance and of mutual respect and understanding between the parents and the son. Most of them, I come in at one point and then I'm out at that point and that's it. You know, I don't know. This is considered a very unsafe topic, and people are generally not comfortable talking about it. So, you know, the conversation ends there. And then if somebody does not bring something up to me, I don't, of course. So, but in one situation, yes. And I've had this feeling multiple times of being at the right place in the right time and the right person. And I didn't organize that.
Yeah. And that one situation, the family was reconciled?
Yes. Yeah. It's not complete peace. There's a huge adjustment for parents to go through when they learn this about their child, and it's not changed overnight. And the respect that we're calling for goes both ways. The son has to respect the parents as much as the parents have to respect the son, and it goes both ways. And so this is a process, but I've seen it happen, and the dynamics of that parent-son relationship are reorganized. That's a whole different process than flat-out rejection. And we're not going to talk about this. Mm-hmm. And don't come home for Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. So
that must have made you feel good.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Worth everything.
You just heard Father Michael Shanahan. He's a priest at Our Lady of Lourdes Church in Chicago. He spoke with Lake Effect Mayan Silver. Shanahan is attending the retreat for gay priests being held at the Siena Center in Racine this week.
We'll take a quick break now and then switch to playoff baseball on tap in Milwaukee for the first time since 2011. We'll preview the series between the Brewers and the Colorado Rockies next on Lake Effect from WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The last month or so of the baseball season has been about defying expectations. The Milwaukee Brewers seemed like they were well on their way to winning a wildcard berth in the playoffs. But then they went on an 8-game winning streak and won the division instead.
And the Cubs, prohibitive favorites in their wildcard game against the Rockies Tuesday night, lost 2-1 in 13 innings, meaning it will be Colorado that comes to Miller Park to open the playoffs later today. It is the crew's first playoff appearance since 2011. Our sports contributor, Sean Ramf, joins us with a look at everything that has gone right so far for the Brewers, knock on wood. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's been a while.
Yeah, it has, but it's great to have you back and for such a good reason here. Now, I don't know that people are not interested in the Packers around here at the moment, but for a while, Milwaukee is really becoming a baseball city this fall.
Yes. Reaching the playoffs for the first time in 7 years will do that. I can't speak for every Packers fan, but the last couple weeks, I have barely paid attention to the actual game action. I have just followed loosely from, you know, GameCast, any sort of phone notifications like that. But
yeah, not too many weeks when the Packers can score a shutout win and it barely registers.
That's how ridiculous this stretch of baseball has been for the Brewers. So normally Wisconsin is all about the Packers once the NFL starts up, and I'm not saying people don't care because they clearly do, but baseball's taken over and it's fun.
Well, and of course the Brewers have been an exciting team all year, but there is really nothing like a city that's going through a pennant race.
They stumbled a little bit in August, and they were actually 6 games out of first on August 28th, and they were even behind the Cardinals at the beginning of September. And then they went 20-7 in the month of September. Expanded rosters definitely helped. They have so much depth. But then having a week where you sweep the Cardinals in St. Louis to clinch a playoff berth, and then the following Monday you beat the Cubs in Wrigley Field to win the division, I don't know how much better you can feel about a Brewers baseball team than after watching that.
And as we saw on Tuesday night, you can be a favored team and still be out of the playoffs.
Yeah, the joint best record in the National League, and they had to play 2-1 game, you know, a tiebreaker for the division and a 1-game playoff. And just, I don't know what happened to their offense. It's been an issue all season. And 2 runs in 22 innings at home, I did not think that was going to happen. So I anticipated a Cubs-Brewers NLDS.
Which would have been really exciting.
It would have been really exciting. It would have been really stressful, probably, for a lot of people. Monday was very stressful for a lot of people, myself included. But it was very fun. The Colorado series is going to be interesting.
It is going to be interesting. So let's talk about what it took for the Brewers to get where they are. We mentioned they won out. They won their last 8 regular season. You can count the 163rd game
counts,
as a regular season game to make it as the division champions. But we can't have this conversation without talking about one specific player with the Brewers who really, you know, they talk in sports about people putting their team on their back. This is really what Christian Yelich did.
Yeah, I think we've run out of words to use. I know I said that about a week ago. I don't think you can say anything else. I saw a week ago or so, they compared his second half to one of Barry Bonds' MVP season second halves, and the numbers were scary close. And if you're approaching territory like that, that just doesn't happen.
Unfortunately, we are not talking about Christian Yelich having 80 home runs.
No, not those kind of numbers, not those silly numbers, but the amount of times he's getting on base, the amount of home runs he hit in the month of September. He's just been incredible, and he had a couple more hits on Monday. He just hasn't stopped, and you keep thinking eventually he's going to slow down, or eventually, and we'll probably see this more once the NLDS starts, teams are going to pitch around him.
There was
maybe
a game that he was walked five times.
Yeah, like at some point you just have to put him on base and hope you get the next guys out.
Fortunately for the Brewers, the next guys are getting hits too.
Yes, Ryan Braun is turning back the clock to 2011. It's been a fun September, October for him. Jesus Aguilar is out of his little mini slump. And even the guys that don't get on base as much, Moustakas and Shaw, there's a lot of power in the Brewers lineup and a lot of power behind Yelich. So you got to take your chances. I'd probably rather face anybody else but Yelich right now, but it doesn't get much easier as far as power opportunities go after he's on base. So,
all right. So let's talk about who the Brewers are going to send to the mound, at least in the first three games of this series. And it is kind of a combination of people who have some playoff cred and some people who are going to be a question mark, right?
Yeah. Right now, because I know Chacin started the tiebreaker. Thursday might be Wade Miley's day, and it is the year 2018, and we are talking about Wade Miley starting a playoff game. And he's been very solid and consistent down the stretch. You'd like to have Chacin out there for game one, but that's a little bit early. He'd probably be a candidate for game two.
And we should mention that Chacin was originally a member of the Rockies pitching staff here. And so that makes things a little bit complicated facing his old team.
Yeah. And that's the other thing. You're talking about a guy like Chacin, too, who will be probably starting a playoff game in the year 2018 and has been very good and consistent. It's almost baffling. And then after that, you maybe think about Gio Gonzalez. I don't know at that point. I know with how deep the Brewers' bullpen has been, the plan is usually to get through five innings and hope from there and go from there. So.
We should mention that there was a game against the Cardinals that the Brewers employed a tactic with their pitching staff that really could have backfired, but worked like a charm.
Yes, throwing Dan Jennings out there to get Matt Carpenter, and that was it. Three pitches, one out, and the rest of the bullpen was great. I thought they were going to do that on Monday against the Cubs, but they went with Chacin.
You mentioned Gio Gonzalez, and for people who might not have paid close attention to the Brewers over the course of the year, he's somebody who came over fairly late in the season from the Washington Nationals, and this is maybe emblematic of how active the Brewers were in getting players, getting pieces of the team from other teams that were out there and putting them to work in the playoff chase.
Yeah, they didn't stop.
Yeah.
They kept exploring all avenues. I was a little baffled by the Jonathan Scope trade because I thought they gave up a lot, and with the year Scope was having, I didn't think he was an upgrade at all. And he's had spurts. He has had first couple weeks he had a brutal stretch. A couple weeks ago, then he has that grand slam off of Madison Bumgarner, which should have changed everybody's perception of him for the rest of the season. I don't think it matters what he does after that. Bringing in Moustakas.
Curtis Granderson,
he'll probably be on the playoff roster. We'll probably talk more about that in a little bit. And then moving Travis Shaw and experimenting with Travis Shaw at second base because they brought in Moustakas. They just kept adding bats. Not fantastic defensive players, but capable. And they just kept throwing names out there, and it's worked so far. So.
Well, and so by the time this interview airs, the playoff roster will be set. So we're going to do a little bit of speculating here and a little bit of talking with a possibility that we could be completely wrong.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to have this conversation about who's going to be on the playoff roster. And at the beginning of the season, if you said the Brewers were going to make the playoffs, it would have been hard to imagine a playoff roster potentially without Eric Thames.
Correct. And he, again, like last year, got off to a really hot start, home runs-wise. The difference is that last year, even in the second half when he was struggling, he was still working walks and getting on base enough, having pretty, solid at-bats. This season has been entirely different. He was injured earlier. He has really struggled the second half of the season, and he hasn't played much. The opportunities just weren't there because Jesus Aguilar took over once Thames got hurt, and Thames was never able to get back into the lineup. And now looking at it, it's hard. It's nearly impossible to make a case for him to be on the postseason roster, which is a bummer. On a general note,
yeah, and it's hard to make that case because going into the playoffs, teams try to keep so many pitchers on their playoff roster.
And the Brewers' strength, especially late in ball games, is the depth of their bullpen. And between them and the Rockies, they both have solid bullpens. Brewers have had way more success with more names, but the Rockies are pretty solid in that department too. So you want to play to your strengths there and just carry the best bench bats that you can on top of it.
It was interesting in the single-game playoff against the Cubs. The guy that was called on to close the game is not the guy that was the Brewers' closer down the stretch. Jeremy Jeffress has been almost unhittable all year, but I gather he was just unavailable.
He was unavailable. I know fans were a little worried because, we know Jeremy's had issues in the past, but none of that was what happened. He was just unavailable.
He had books overdue at the library. Something
like that. but everything's fine with him, and he's with the team. And from what I understand, Stearns and Council have already said that he will be a full participant in the NLDS. So I'm expecting that we'll see him close again. He was the shutdown guy at the end of games late in the season here. So. It was nice that Council does have the ability to go to either Knebel, which he has used Knebel all over the place in the last month, or Hader, as we saw him close out two innings on Monday. So he has options.
So then I guess the question is, what's the biggest question mark for the Brewers going into playoffs?
The biggest
Starting
question
pitching,
mark
maybe?
Is maybe we've said that all season, I feel like. And every time we think, oh, they just need that one, stopper, like you need an ace or an ace type pitcher that they don't have by the technical definition.
They don't have a Clayton Kershaw.
They don't have a DeGrom or even like, a Cole,
John Lester,
a Cole Hamels or John Lester is a perfect example. Yeah. But if they can just get five innings or so out of their starters and turn it over to the bullpen, I think that'll be enough for most games. I don't know if it'll be enough if they keep advancing. It gets a little taxing. But they have figured out a formula, and it has worked so far.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Colorado Rockies, who had to have almost maybe as impressive a stretch towards the end of the season as the Brewers did to be in this position as well.
Yeah, and I think the biggest thing about the Rockies this season, the last couple seasons, especially this one, is that their pitching, their starting pitching particularly, is a strength. we saw Kyle Freeland on Tuesday. He has the lowest ERA in Rockies history, I believe.
I
believe that is correct. And then they have Marquez, who had the most strikeouts this season in Rockies franchise history. They have pitchers now. The odd thing is that their offense isn't nearly as good as it has been. They have, top of the order bats are very good. They have some power scattered throughout, but their pitching is really good. And they can go deeper into ball games than most Brewers pitchers are allowed to. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out as well.
So the conventional wisdom that when the series goes back to Coors Field, these are not games that are necessarily going to end up 10-8 as they might have.
No, and there's been a couple of, I think only one game ended nearly that close between the two teams this season, and it was a ridiculous. I think the Brewers were down 9-3 late and rallied to win 10-9, and that was the only game that was anything like that. So I think we're going to see a lot of good pitching. Both teams hit home runs, so you'll see them regardless of where they're playing. And, it's not quite lining up against, Lester, Quintana, Hamels, Hendricks, whoever else the Cubs can throw out there, but the Rockies have a lot of good pitchers. So it's going to be fun. And if you're the Brewers, you just got to hope that what you've been doing all season keeps working, because getting Chacin through, 17 outs on Monday against the Cubs, and he gave up one hit. That is, if you can get that out of every one of your starters in these games, that's probably going to be enough.
And you have to think, if you're a baseball fan anywhere, following this series is just going to be a joyous affair.
Yeah, I think it's going to be fun. I don't know how MLB would feel about it if it was a potential NLCS matchup between Colorado and Milwaukee, but this is an interesting series for two teams that really haven't made their mark in the postseason in quite some time.
Let's face it, the other two teams in the NL playoffs, Los Angeles, you can always kind of count on to be out there, but Atlanta, nobody would have guessed.
It's been a while for Atlanta, and they were supposed to be similar to how the Brewers kind of—they didn't tear it down like the Astros and the Cubs did, like everyone thought they might. But they, the Braves did that a few years ago when it seemed like they didn't have to. And it even seemed that this season they were probably at least a year away. But I don't know what happened to the Nationals. Nobody knows what happened to the Nationals with that amount of talent. And the Phillies, the poor Phillies just crumbled in August, September. And that was, you know, flashbacks to 2014 Brewers season. Not, and that might, they might have even crumbled worse. I think it might have been later in the season and worse for Phillies fans. So yeah, the Braves, they took advantage, and they've been really exciting to watch too. They have pitching everywhere and a lot of good young players, and you just think, you know, the Dodgers are the Dodgers. So they have all the talent. They have, you know, they add Manny Machado at the trade deadline, and it seems like nobody even realizes he's there. It just kind of happens, and they still had to play a one game tiebreaker to win their division, and it's the NL playoff race is really interesting. The field is really, it's not an obvious choice, I don't think, to come out of the National League.
Well, so not to ask a sobering question to end this, but I'm going to anyway.
That is fair.
The Brewers added so many players over the course of the year. What does this team look like next year? Is this a, I mean, is this a win now or never kind of situation? Or how many of the guys that we're seeing carrying the load this year are going to be part of the Brewers' plans next year?
I don't think it's a win now or never. They definitely, I mean, their farm system is definitely on the lower end now. They've depleted a lot there. But they, all these young arms you've seen come up in September, they're going to be there next year. The way, you know, guys like Scope, he's under contract through next season. He'll be there. Granderson obviously was just a rental piece to get another left-handed bat and a solid clubhouse guy, maybe.
He's going to be in the broadcast booth next year.
Yeah,
right?
Something, you know, like that. And Gio Gonzalez, again, he was, his contract is up, so he's probably not going to be around next year. But the anyone else? I know Moustakas has a mutual option, so it'll depend on both sides there. Yelich is around for a while. Kane is here for a few more years after that. Braun is still under contract. But I don't think the team changes too much. And guys like Domingo Santana, who he's come on late as a pinch hitter off the bench, he's still around for a while, and maybe he'll have more opportunities next season. The team, from a positional standpoint, at least their active starting roster, is going to be mostly the same. Because 2011 was fun. Winning the division in 2011 was a lot of fun, and having guys like Zach Greinke was excellent. But immediately after that, you know, you lose Prince Fielder in free agency, and the next year your team craters a bit, and you have to get rid of everybody and start all over. And I don't think they're in any danger of that for a few years at least.
Well, Sean Ranft, let's hope we're still talking about this team in a week or two.
Yeah, I would like to be back to talk about that.
All right.
Thank you.
We'll cross our fingers. Thanks.
Thanks.
Sean Ranft is the managing editor for the website The Sports Post, and he's our sports contributor. You can find more of our baseball stories at WUWM.com.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Musician Mark Revenson, known to nearly all as Lil Rev, is a veritable ambassador to his instrument. Based in Sheboygan, he travels not just around Wisconsin, but around the country, sharing his love for the ukulele. Rev's most recent album is called Sing Song Daddy, but his next gig is about more than his own music.
Lil Rev is also the organizer or the convener of the Great Lakes Ukulele Gathering, which will bring players and lovers of the instrument together to Anodyne Coffee in Walker's Point next Sunday, the 14th. He joined us in the studio to talk about the event and the instrument and to play a few tunes. Thank you.
old Sheboygan soft shoe, Little Rev, in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. Thank you so much. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you. It's really great to be back here with you, Mitch. Nice to see you.
It has been a while, and I was thinking about this. Probably the first time we spoke, gosh, maybe it was 10 years ago, and I feel like 10 years ago almost was what felt like the beginning of the ukulele renaissance at that point.
That's right. Yeah, it's to the point now where you know, for a while we were all calling it a revival of interest, right? You know, and now it's obvious that it's here to stay. It's become entrenched in American pop culture again, and more importantly, at a grassroots level, it's touching all aspects of American life at a time when we desperately needed to become participants again rather than just observers. And when I say that, as I may have said in the past, I mean people, you know, the instrument got America singing again. You know, we needed that. We needed to find our voice again at a time when almost everything seemed to sound alike or canned or what have you. You know, we got kids playing ukuleles in schools now and ensembles and bands. We got seniors at in retirement communities getting together a couple times a month to be in ukulele clubs. And all aspects of civic involvement are being touched by the beauty and the music of ukulele across the country. And this flowering, you know, of a movement has been really exciting to watch as I dare call myself, you know, Johnny Appleseed, because there are many others above me.
Well, but it's a pretty appropriate metaphor, actually, because you travel the country and in some ways, you have been a key figure in making this instrument what it is nationally today.
Well, you know, was it happenstance? Was it luck? Did I find the instrument, or did the instrument find me? You know, it used to be a little place called Nash's Irish Castle over on Lincoln Street. A great little place, the best little secret for a Friday night fish fry, you know. And one night, one of my fans gave me a ukulele that was an old beat up family heirloom, and that started it.
That was the first time.
That was the first time, you know, so early 90s. And then just finding the other ukulele geeks around the country at expos and gatherings on the Eastern Seaboard. And then from that, it just kind of a few little festivals sprung up, like-minded players finding each other. And now today, and you know, that was before YouTube and videos that went viral, like Jake Shimabukuro's While My Guitar Gently Weeps, later Is, and many other popular groups that help, you know, really.
Is, for people who are not familiar, is Israel Kamaka Viva Ole.
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah. Singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow. But meanwhile, somewhere under the rainbow, here we all are, you know, plucking and strumming and plunking away. And, you know, it's just really wonderful. So this is the third, you know, coming of the ukulele, the teens and 20s when the Hawaiian brought it here, and then the 50s and 60s from Arthur Godfrey to Tiny Tim, and then, you know, just kind of fell off again. But this time it's so, you know, entrenched, as I said earlier, in so many aspects of our society. There's hundreds of ukulele clubs. There's, you know, dozens of festivals and all over the country and the world, for that matter. And then, of course, there's a publishing industry and the infrastructure of manufacturing and creating instruments like our own Hal Leonard here in Milwaukee, whom I've been very fortunate to have a great relationship writing instructional books with. And all these things have just kind of served one another in a really, really organic manner, you know.
You mentioned Tiny Tim. Tiny Tim really would not be unique today. He would not get the same kind of attention that he did when he was Tiny Tim.
No, you know, I mean, it's kind of funny when you think of that, you know. Tiny Tim was a novelty. He knew it, and he came along at a time. This is my own theory, but, you know, 1968, I believe, was the year of God Bless Tiny Tim, Tiptoe Through the Tulips, the release of that album, his later appearance on Johnny Carson, and that sort of thing. But, you know, Tiny Tim was a novelty. He milked it to the nth degree. And he came along at a time in the village and down in the village when Bob Dylan was playing at little cafes, when there weren't too many ukulele players out there, and he had shtick.
You were talking about that first time that you had I keep saying ukulele, but it is ukulele. Was it love at first sight or at first strum or pluck?
You know, for me, it kind of came in waves. I was given a banjo ukulele, and so banjo ukulele is brash. It's real bright. It's real upfront. It's in your face, and that's why banjos take all the bad jokes, you know, in terms of instruments. But
that viola, right?
That's right. but there was something inherent in the sound and these four strings, you know, tuned My Dog Has Fleas. So when you hear this, you know, you hear that sound, there's something sweet about it. And it's lilting, it's happy, it's inviting, and it's intimate. And as your fingers touch the strings, it just feels good. And as time went on, I just kind of fell in love with that sort of connection, not really understanding initially. Eventually, I found an old Favia ukulele at a pawn shop in Madison, and that became my main ukulele till I wore the top off of it. And I had to take it over to Luthier Denny Round to put a little pick guard, make a homemade pick guard like Willie Nelson, as the face of his guitar. I wore the top off of it. With each year, I became more in love with the instrument, what it offered, and how it was sweet for accompanying the voice, fun to write songs on, things I couldn't do on the guitar as a guitarist, I was doing on the ukulele. It was a lot more inviting and user-friendly, and maybe that's why so many people are finding it to be an instrument that is, really practical if you want to play music and choose to pick an instrument.
There is also something to be said for an instrument that weighs about 1 pound.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, this is not the instrument, you know, at night when the barroom brawl breaks out that you're going to protect yourself with, you know.
But I'm looking at the instrument that you have there, and I'm guessing this is not the one that the pick guard was added to.
No.
But it is a beautiful instrument.
Yeah, the one that I have here in the studio with you, Mitch, is it's a sycamore wood around. It was made on white salmon, Washington, Hood River, Oregon, by a company called Maya Moe, whom I was working with for a long time. These days, I've spent a lot of time with a company called Kanalea, which builds them, over in Hawaii. And so, you develop affinity for different tonal woods. And now there's a whole way beyond a cottage industry of both large manufacturers and small shop luthiers building instruments, and more work than they can handle, for sure.
Well, I feel like at this point, we haven't even mentioned the fact that you have a new album out. It's called Sing Song Daddy, and I think we should hear another song from it.
Oh, that'd be wonderful here. I'm going to put on the little harmonica rack as well, and I'm going to play a tune called The Milwaukee Waltz. And when you make music in Milwaukee, invariably you got to slow down once in a while. And people come in, they ask for all kinds of different things. You want to make a living in Milwaukee as a musician. The advice we give you, those of us who have been doing it for a little while, is to be diverse. Know how to play lots of different kinds of music, because people are going to ask you for that. We're a diverse town. Every once in a while, towards the end of the night, people want a slow dance. And that's usually where the waltz comes in. And so... I could only sing Tennessee Waltz and the Goodnight Irene so many times before I had to write a new waltz to contribute to the canon. So here it is, the Milwaukee Waltz.
Waltz across Texas, misery too, out of the Midwest into the blue. If I could waltz my whole life through, waltz in Milwaukee with you. Baby, won't you shake my blues away? Honey, we could polka most any place. And if I'm gonna love you your dying day, let's waltz in Milwaukee, steal the night away. Tennessee was fine whole night through. Waltz across Ohio neath a big harvest moon. Nothing that makes me feel so blue, it's when I'm not waltzing with you. Baby, won't you shake my blues away. Honey, we could polka most any play. And if I'm gonna love you, your dying day, let's waltz in Milwaukee and steal the night away. Oh, come on now, let's steal it, little Rev. Waltzing ain't hip, and waltzing ain't cool. But baby, when you're waltzing, you make me cool. To me, go from me, shoe foot shoe. One, two, three, darling, I do. Baby, won't you shake my blues away? Honey, we could polka most any play. And if I'm gonna love you to your dying day, let's waltz in Milwaukee and steal the night away.
Lil Rev, that is the Milwaukee Waltz, performed right here in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Mitch.
We mentioned the new album, the new-ish album. It's been out for a little while, and I was looking. There is a veritable who's who of local luminary musicians that also played with you on this album.
Yeah, so my most recent ukulele release, Sing Song Daddy, the title comes from my daughter when she was a little girl. She used to and could barely talk. She'd say, "Sing Song Daddy." And so it's a collection of original music, and I tend to stagger what I do between original releases and traditional music. And that this particular collection, involves a lot of really great players on there. You know, the Seegers and Robin Plur and Jim Liban, just all kinds of really wonderful players. I could go on and on. There's really blessed to have James Iannelli and Peter Roller and some of my local music, many of my local music heroes, people I grew up listening to. I'm making music and recording with these days, and they help make this album as good as I believe it turned out to be.
The other thing I want to make sure we talk about is you convene a group of a large group of ukulele players every year in what was originally, I think, called the Milwaukee Ukulele Festival, and it is now expanded to a full-fledged regional affair.
That's right. In about, I don't know, 08, 09, that time period, Dave Thornton and Sherilyn Kelly, Mark Peterson, Jack Johnson, myself, we all put together a little Milwaukee ukulele club, and it's grown over the years. And while I'm in Sheboygan now these days, the club's continued to grow. It meets over at Brass Bell, who's one of our festival sponsors, and there are many other little ukulele spinoff groups in town as well. The Ukuleles and all this is just this flowering that we've seen. The Milwaukee Ukulele Festival, getting to be 9-10 years now that we've been plugging away. We took 1 year off to just kind of revamp things. And, late 2015, I lost my first wife to lung cancer. So, everybody just took a step back and took a deep breath. And now we're back. We switched from Sunset Playhouse to Anodyne Coffee Roasters, another one of our sponsors in Walker's Point. So the Great Lakes Ukulele Gathering is what we're calling it, just a fresh coat of paint on there. We've got two national acts coming in, Neil Chin and Casey McGill. Blues, jazz, swing, novelty, classes all day long.
So this is really there are things to do for people who want to brush up on their playing skills, but also for people who just enjoy the sound of the instrument. You have opportunities for people to come in and just listen.
That's right. Our concert is from 4 to 6 p.m. and that's open to the community. It's a 2-hour show. The Ukulele Sunshine Band is a local group, and they'll open up the show. Then I'm going to follow with Jim Liban on harmonica and James Iannelli helping me out for some bluesy kind of stuff on the ukulele. And then Neil Chin, who's a Seattle guy, plays jazz, and followed by Casey McGill, who does all the big band and swing and novelty type stuff. So it's going to be a really great show. And, of course, in a wonderful venue down there in the on the edge of the Third Ward there at Anodyne Coffee Roasters.
Well, Lil Rev, it's great to see both you and the festival doing so well.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
And do you have another maybe a little instrumental you're going to play us out with?
Sure. I'm going to play a little piece called the Ashtabula Upstroke, a little piece that was written inspired by an old fellow who came up to me. He came up to me after a nursing home gig, and he said, "You did the Ashtabula Upstroke."
Lil Rev playing us out with the Ashtabula Upstroke. You can find more information about the Great Lakes Ukulele Gathering from a link at WUWM.com. Our in-studio session was engineered by Jason Reavy. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tighe. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.